past 7, live on BBC Radio 3.
Yes, well, in around an hour's time this evening, Jazz Now, Al Ryan presents a special edition from Soweto Kinch's flyover show in Birmingham, with music from many of the artists appearing, including Ayanna Whitta-Johnson, Zara McFarlane, and Blue Lab Beats. Jazz Now is at 11 o'clock. Now, though, it's just gone 10, time for the Radio 3 Proms Poetry Competition, recorded earlier this evening and introduced by Ian McMillan.
Welcome to this celebration of the creative collision between music and words that is the Proms Poetry Competition. Each year, here at the BBC Proms, we encourage a kind of creative listening, a poetic leaning into the radio or the television or towards the stage at the Royal Albert Hall. We ask people to take notes from the air and shape them on the page and reshape them into poems and send them in to us. Joining me here on the stage are my fellow judges, the award-winning poet Helen Mort and Judith Palmer from the Poetry Society, our associates in the competition. We've also got the actor Carolyn Pickles with us. She'll be reading the winning entries, and of course, we're joined by our winners. So, let me remind you of the rules. There were two categories, aged 12 to 18 and 19 to as old as you possibly can get. To enter, you had to write a poem inspired by a piece of music performed at this year's Proms concerts. Now, inspired by could be interpreted in any number of ways. The poem could be about sitting and experiencing a performance of the work. It could perhaps remind the writer of where they were and what they were doing the first time they heard it. It could be about performing the piece, or the poem could be an attempt to describe or comment on music in language that has a musicality of its own. There were well over 100 different musical performances that inspired our contestants' writing this year. The most inspirational piece was Ralph Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending. We've also had many entries inspired by Leonard Bernstein's The Age of Anxiety, one of the pieces to mark Bernstein's centenary, the folk music around Britain Island Prom, and Daphne Oram's Still Point, inspired by the electronic work by Delia Derbyshire and her colleagues at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And also, more female composers inspired you than in any other year of this competition. Now, Judith, I'm impressed by so many things about this competition, but this year I was really impressed by the range of music, the number of different pieces that inspired people this year.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's always a few pieces of music like The Lark Ascending, which every year people will write about, and which just shows how much people love that piece of music. But it's also a lesson every year in all the proms that you missed, when you see, God, that's really interesting, and then you go and look it up and see this amazing music that you missed. There was Anna Meredith's Five Telegrams was one that came up quite a lot as well, and I had missed that, and I went back and listened to that, and there were some really amazing interpretations of that, I thought.
It's interesting that with Ralph Vaughan Williams' Lark Ascending, we had, as you said, a number of different looks at that, a number of different ways of interpreting that. Would you advise an entrant to go for a more popular or a less popular piece?
It's whatever inspires you, isn't it? I don't think that matters at all. I would say, I mean, we had actually some really, really good Lark Ascending poems this year, but it is quite a hard poem to finish, I think, I find, that people love that piece of music so much, and it's really hard to find a different way into it, to make a poem out of it. But as long as the music inspires you in some way, it doesn't matter. I mean, we find that sometimes we select something that's was very specific to this year's proms, and sometimes an old favourite, so it doesn't make any difference.
Now, Helen, I think that if you wanted to enter the competition, you decided in advance you were going to write about a particular piece of music, you would then, I don't know, force yourself to listen to that music in a different way, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing that I guess you're trying to do when you're writing about a piece of music, and I should say that I really take my hat off to everyone who entered and succeeded in this task, because it's not really something I've ever really managed to do, apart from working with a flamenco guitarist, and I found that very challenging to add something to the music. You want a poem that's closely related to the piece, that captures the spirit of the piece, but you also want it to do more than just narrate and just rephrase what the music already tells us, because the music, of course, has a language of its own as well. So it's a very subtle dance between the two, I think.
And it's interesting that what happens is we get sent to our separate homes piles of poems, and it was interesting that the eventual winners and runners-up floated to the top very quickly, didn't they? Which must prove in some way that they are good poems, because the three of us will read and enjoy poems in different ways, and yet these good poems bubbled up, didn't they?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that happening in competitions where favourites are emerging independently, but they're often the same favourites. And then you start to compare notes, and often the judges have seen very different qualities in the same poem, and so you realise that it stands up to multiple different readings as well, and that's really exciting.
That's true, it's the multiple different readings, isn't it, that we don't all see the same thing in the poem. Let's hear one of the runners-up in the 12 to 18 category. It's by Matilda Janssen-Toft, who's 13 years old, and Forgotten Host is read by Carolyn Pickles.
I am Diana, Moonstrider, goddess of the hunt, the closest celestial body to Earth. I have gone by many names, Selene, Artemis, Chang'e. Wrapped in my triste grey cloak, I dance to the sides of the main procession, sweeping my chariot in a lentando diminuendo to the dewy grass where I sleep, forgotten in the woods. Goddess of wisdom and warfare, Minerva is my name. An asteroid, I wait in silencio for greater recognition. A dwarf planet is all I ask. My metal helm will shield me for now as my volti subito orbit twists around the sun, tracking Mars, the bringer of war, waiting for my chance to rise in a celestial crescendo. Do not mistake me for wanting a planet. As Vesta, hearthkeeper, it is my duty to place others in comfort. My plea is for Pluto, no longer recognized, silent in the abyss of the heavens. Though sometimes I watch the Earth's rotations in confusion, why not name such a sheltering planet after a goddess whose duty is shelter? I suppose all of us must fade away and niente in the end.
Helen, what I liked best about that poem, I think, was that when I read it, I thought it was going to take a certain direction when I'd read the first few lines, and then it didn't. It went off, actually, to the edge of the heavens, didn't it?
And I just love the voice in that poem. It seems like an obvious thing to say, but I think so many of the entries that I admired created a character, and you sort of felt like, yes, if this music was a person, this is exactly what they'd sound like, and that's very much the case with that one.
And it seemed to me, Judith, that that poem is a thing to bear in mind for competition enterers, to try not to do the obvious. Because the obvious wasn't any part of that poem, was it?
Not at all. Though, I mean, it was in response to the planets, and that is one of the pieces of music that, again, always does come up. But I thought that was great, taking what Holst hadn't written about, and it also takes you to the naming of asteroids and planets and the order in which they're discovered and why they're one thing, not another, and the female that is maybe more absent in some of the naming. But I think also this poet was one of the youngest, actually, out of all of the entrants we had. And given that, I think that was also really amazing.
It is, because the musical language is impressive. I was impressed by the mixing of line lengths, longer lines, shorter lines. There was a huge poetic confidence, I felt, in that poem.
Oh, that line, "Do not mistake me for wanting a planet."
Yeah.
Very bold, sure of itself line. But, I mean, a lot of poems, they did sort of sprinkle musical language in the poems, but often you really felt it was like, I better put this in somewhere. And in this poem, the poet had absolutely managed to put it in the right place. And I love that ending. I suppose all of us must fade away and niente in the end. I thought it was a wonderful ending.
So, Helen, when you read a poem like that, when we're judging poems, the first few lines, is that what attracts you to something like that? We read them several times, but for myself, I'm often, the first few lines have to pull me in.
Yeah, I think you're looking for a certain kind of confidence, not an arrogance, but a confidence in the voice and something that's going to compel you and convince you that you're in safe hands as well. I think all good poems do that. It doesn't have to be a voice that you like. It's not necessary for it to be like that, but it has to be one that you trust to carry you through the poem. And yeah, that's certainly true of that one.
And Judith, we've always had these categories for younger people and older people. And concessions isn't the right word, but we don't make concessions to the younger people. But do we read them in a different way, do you think?
I think maybe we're tolerant of a little bit more exuberance, a little excess. I mean, if you can't be a little excessive when you're a teenager, when can you be? So possibly a little bit more, ebullience and purpleness of the passion of discovering a piece of music for the first time. Maybe we like a little more control, maybe, in the adults, but I don't know.
Sometimes the exuberance bumps into angst and they fight together for a while in the poem, don't they?
They can.
Not always a good thing. A general question about the poems. Do you think, I tried this with one or two of the entries, I listened to the piece of music they were writing about as I read the poem. And that seemed to illuminate it for me. Did you try that, Helen?
I didn't try that, but I tried reading them out loud myself. I often do that which is maybe a really terrible thing to do to someone else's poem. Because you're probably getting the voice wrong, you might be getting the rhythm wrong, but just to get a sense of how it sounded, and it's because I was thinking of the sound of the music, but actually the music of the poems as well, and the sound of the poems. So I did a lot of talking to myself.
And what about you, Judith? Do you listen to the music?
I do, but as you're saying, we read them a lot of times, and so the first pass, you're sort of like, you think you're trying to get the pile down from in half, and you realise you've only maybe weeded out two, and then you have to be, I have to be harsher, and you go back through, and then, you find one you really like, and then you think, okay, that's my benchmark now. But then once we've got a sort of a long list, I do always go and listen to the music, and then it often really does open a poem up. Or I think that is the poem that you wrote that you thought, I'm sure I can find a way to sneak this in somehow.
All right, well, our second runner-up is by Ian Harker in the over 18 category and was inspired by Benjamin Britten's 4-seat interludes from Peter Grimes. Carolyn.
Every pylon we pass is the tower, and the tower is a tram made of light bulbs. The sea is shipping containers, and the seafront is a slot machine sliding on 2 P's. The pier is the glass giraffe we bought for Grandma. The tide is going out between the floorboards. All the dogs are made of shells, and I want everyone to be lit like this. Dots of light across our foreheads, on our wrists. A seagull's feather flies out of my hand, back into what it knows best. The feather and the beach are the same shape, and the feather and the beach are the same colour. And the voices on the ghost train will not be drowned.
That was Sea Interlude by Ian Harker. Do you know, Helen, I loved the intimacy of that poem, the grandma's glass giraffe and the seagull's feather in the hand. But then, towards the end of the poem, the intimacy becomes a kind of mystery and a sort of magnificence, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like I felt that it was like a sort of secular prayer. It reminded me a little bit of what I like about a poem like Caroline Duffy's poem Prayer, actually, where it's the poetry in the everyday. I love the idea of wanting everyone to be lit like this. Mm. I think it's incredibly resonant.
And there were some wonderful images in there, Judith, that leapt out at us, weren't there?
Oh, for me, it's the image of the Penny Arcade and with the sort of the 2 P's all lined up, and seeing the sea and the tide coming in as that sort of penny falls. And for me, I had so many summer holidays with my brother having to be dragged out of the Penny Arcade with him begging for just a few more pennies. So that image, that's so closely connected. It's definitely not Aldborough, is it, this sea interlude?
No.
So it's a different experience of the seaside, but one that just really resonates. And seeing the tide going out from underneath the pier, the slats of the pier, is great.
And there's a repetition, Helen, of the and the beach. That comes in twice. And sometimes in writing workshops, you'll say, don't repeat things. But this repetition works, doesn't it?
Yeah, all good poems break rules in some way. And yeah, there's always something of that. And I think mostly poems that win competitions, it's things that maybe, you might think, if in a workshop they might say this, but everything's earning its place, and that's what's great about it. I also really enjoyed as well the fact that Blackpool had come into... I didn't expect, when I was thinking about music, responding to the proms and to classical music, that I was going to end up in Blackpool, and I was so glad that I did.
No, it's great to see places like Blackpool celebrated, I think, in this kind of poem. And you mentioned the ending, Judith, and to me, I wrote the word transubstantive. It kind of feels like you're being changed by that ending as a reader and a listener.
Ooh, am I changed by the ending? Well, that's the sea for you, isn't it? Going in, going out, we're all changed and never the same water twice.
And now it's time for our first winner of this year's competition, inspired by Brahms's A German Requiem. Let's hear a short part of the Brahms. part of Brahms' German Requiem, played by the BBC Symphony Chorus and Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Richard Farnes. And the winner of our 19-plus category is Rachel Curzon. Let's hear her poem, and then we'll meet her. So, Carolyn, let's hear the poem, Grass Like His Mother.
Denn alles Fleisch, es ist wie Gras. Though not the brittle shiftings of a parched field, those stiff yellows scorched to desiccation, but the grass that leans, restive, into crosswinds, and that beckons winter sun to touch it gold. Grass like his mother, praying at her sickroom window, palms against the pane and blazing, every finger bright with light or grace.
And Rachel, please join us on the stage. Let's welcome her with applause. Rachel, that really is a fabulous poem. Can you tell us your process of moving from the music to the words?
It was quite fragmentary. It started with just an image, really, an image of scorched earth. We've had a lot of that over this summer, so it was all around me. I just had to look out of my window, actually, at our patch of lawn. And then the idea that grass could be withered and it also could be blazing in sunlight. And I really wanted to get across that sense of both opportunities, both possibilities.
And so then it began with that, with the image. And then I'm always interested in the drafting process. So did you then take notes? Was the shape of the poem there quite early on?
I had it in my head for a while, I think, before I wrote it down, and it was, it cooked for a bit before I started to write it. Then there was the tweaking afterwards. But no, I think before I put pen to paper, I think I had the idea that it was going to be in those couplets and that it was going to be quite spare. That was the intention.
I'm interested in the couplets because in a lot of the entries this year, people were writing in couplets. Couplets seem to be this year's thing. What do you think it is about a couplet? Because it's a beautiful form, partly because of the white space between the couplets. But what do you think a couplet can do to a poem or for a poem?
Well, the bit that we just heard from the second movement, though, that to me it's just a great stately and powerful opening. And that sort of sense of procession seemed to lend itself really well to that, the couplets coming out.
And so that's how you wanted the relationship of the music and the words to be?
It was an accident. When they arrived, I sort of thought, oh, OK, that seems to fit.
And the poem itself is not particularly long, and I think sometimes people make the mistake when they enter these competitions of writing poems that go right up to the limit of what the number of lines can be. And yet, of course, poetry is concentrated language. Mm. And I was pleased that your poem was short. In the early drafts, was it much longer? Are you the kind of writer who drafts down?
No, I'm a woman of few words, actually. I think it grew, actually.
Oh, so it started off as one couplet and then grew.
It's probably a haiku to begin with.
I would love one year if a haiku won. I don't know if anybody else would, but I quite like that. Tell me about your writing life. Are you in a poetry group? Do you write with other people?
No, not at the moment. I do write when I can. I've got a little baby, so that's sort of fitted around his sleepless nights and picking his dinner off me. But yeah, so that's the work in progress at the moment, trying to get back to it.
But presumably then a spur like this, a competition with its deadline, with its very specific brief of writing something very specific, is a help to someone like yourself who hasn't got a lot of writing time.
It was a real gift, actually, to have a deadline and a lovely brief and the opportunity to listen to that piece again. And no, it was a real privilege.
This was one of the poems, Judith, wasn't it, that again bubbled to the top quite quickly. And what was it about the poem that you found particularly attractive or particularly felt like it would be a winner?
I think it's really interesting. You mentioned about the scorched grass, because for me, it spoke so much to this summer, and that was, for me, what pulled it out immediately. I was actually reading the poems in the garden, and the first rain fell that had fallen for really, like, 6 weeks or something. And I loved that sense that in the scripture that Brahms is drawing from, I think the idea is of all human flesh is as grass it goes. But actually, I've been, like, so impressed by the resilience of grass and how it can spring back. And so that's been in my mind quite a lot. And I thought the way that you had responded to something that was so particular about this summer, that was, for me, how it came about, I think.
And what about you? What got you? Because we all said it was a great poem, and as you said before, we all had different views of why it was good. So what was it that you liked about the poem?
I think that all really good poems contain a surprise in them, but a surprise that also feels utterly convincing and earned. And that was really true of this, that point in the poem. And it is, as you say, it's a spare poem, which makes it all the more impressive to work that turn, if you like, in. But the part where the comparison comes in, the grass like his mother, that image really startled me. Even though we'd already seen those words, there was something about the way that image was developed that I found really compelling and surprising at the same time, and that's what kept me going back to it.
The sound of it as well, I think, with all the eyes, it's a sound that you don't actually get a lot in poems, I think. It's got a very sharp, whippy sort of sound to it, like that long grass that you're describing, the sort of winds, desiccation, shifting, brittle. The sound of it really stood out, I think.
Mm. Well, thank you very much, Rachel.
Thank you very
much. Rachel Kern. Let's hear now. One of the runners-up in the 12 to 18 category is by Aidan Tullock and was inspired by the national anthem arranged by Benjamin Britten, and the poem's called Into National Anthem.
Ancient 14-bar meadow, please forgive how words mowed you down, how they murdered your plain chant margins of Queen Anne's lace, your hushed lutes in hedges, in woods, and in fields that became guns, killing at a flag, learnt by rote, chanted back by cowerers afraid of death, bereft of life. To be pumped around our auto-tuned towns, where homelessness and gambling addictions are long to reign over us like hail. The miners and dockers that trudge through the shadows of cleaners and poets, and two up, two down, dropped H's, 10 kids's, speculating for happiness. And universal creditors lending against gloriousness, playing payday pawn shop Pictionary with a blind couple from witness. And in South Kensington, mid-September, the rumoured home of Hitler's other testicle, lines and lines and lines of caged macaws dutifully sing for the open air, God save our... A suppressed pianissimo that waits, gracious queen, a fearsome chord that grates through centuries, to echo around a catacomb, a cave, a heath, the frail C minor, and then the silence.
Thank you very much, Caroline Pickles. That, Helen, that poem, it really does demand to be read aloud, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I was talking before about surprise, and there were a lot of... a lot of things in that poem that I wasn't expecting when I started reading the competition entries. I think it's really bold. And also, I think, yeah, it's a kind of a declaration, which, again, is fitting to the music that it's responding to. And you've got to admire someone for taking on the national anthem as well, haven't you?
I think it is our first ever national anthem entry. And it's interesting, isn't it, that there was so much in it, and I took my time with the poem when I read it. I read it over and over again, and each time I read it, more things came out, the macaws, the Hitler's testicle, all that. There was jokes in it, there were serious things in it, and at the end, it kind of faded away, didn't it?
Yeah, it was sort of like opening a box that had arrived in the post, and then instead of something that you had to take out, everything sort of leaps out of it at you. It was that kind of experience.
It was like a jack-in-the-box in that way. And Judith, this is a question we often ponder in this Poems Poetry Competition programme, which is there a difference between a poem and a poem that you enter for a competition? So, in other words, you could write a poem which you'd take along to a workshop and we'd talk about it, and we'd then perhaps end up with a different version of that poem. But a poetry competition poem has to stand on its own two feet and has to say, here I am the finished article, I am worthy of winning.
Well, I think it certainly helps get your attention, but I think Rachel's poem proves that actually you don't have to be all jack-in-a-box to get the attention. In this case, this certainly did put everything up front pretty quickly. It's tumbling out of it. It is just a great big rush of ideas and exuberant language. And yes, I mean, somebody was having really good fun with language, and we had to reward that, I think.
And I did like the lines had a rhythmic power to them, but they weren't of a kind of an obvious stressed rhythm, but often there was the rhythm of speech, there was the rhythm of anger, There was the rhythm of comedy. There was the rhythm of the way people talk on the street, it seemed to me.
They did, and there's some really good internal rhymes going on as well. You know, and then towards the end, you've got the sort of pianissimo that waits and the chord that grates, which sort of surprises at the end as well with that rhyme. So, yeah, lots of different devices. But I think, yeah, just the language in that middle stanza and the rhythm of that language, I agree, is the thing.
And I was thinking about that when I was reading all these poems. I suddenly had this kind of fantasy where I thought, I wonder if we had a short story competition one year and we got people to write pieces of fiction based around these. They'd obviously be different in form, but it might not be as good somehow. Because what do you think, Helen? The idea of somehow the poem seems a perfect response to the music that we're hearing.
Yeah, and partly because of that musicality that it has as well. There's something nice, I think there's something nice about the synergy that's going on there. So we all know, all of us who've loved music of any kind or listened to music know that music holds narrative for us, or it holds images that we might consider to be poetic, but equally poems have their own music, a very particular kind of music, and the effects you can achieve within the condensed space of the poem, I think, are really powerful. I'm not saying that short stories don't have their own music too, but I think it's so concentrated in a poem, it makes it an ideal response.
I think it's just that maybe with a story you'd have to have some kind of narrative. I think, Judith, we ought to have some kind of blind tasting sometime when we get people to read these poems and the listener has to guess which piece of music they're about. Do you think that would illuminate something about the poem and about the music?
I think it could offer up a new layer, certainly. You'd have to be very learned, wouldn't you, to sort of have listened to everything and be able to pin it down. You could do that, surely.
Of course, because I listen to everything
you
twice.
You do, yes.
But just the idea that... And then it would help us to think of the link, I think, because sometimes the link's not obvious, but when you find the link, it's worth searching for, I guess.
But I think, you know, although we were saying earlier, you know, sometimes the link may be a little tenuous... I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, inspiration, it takes you in an area you're not expecting. And in some of these, it's clearly it's just a few words rubbing together that has really started a poem off. And who are we to say that that inspiration is appropriate and that isn't really inspired by the music? Because if you just listened to it and it just took you to another place and then you wrote that poem, you have been inspired by that piece of music, haven't you?
You certainly have. Now, the winner of the 12 to 18 category is 18-year-old Annabel Fuller. Her winning poem, Ode to Oud, was inspired by the world premiere of Jessica Wells's Rhapsody for Solo Oud, heard in the Ancient Rituals and New Tales prom. Played there by Joseph Tamadros. Caroline, could you read us Ode to Oud?
Sliced like a pear, pips pop between the strings and frets and slide like incensed sand into my hair. Stone-walled and mortar-bared, black, dusty, spare, breeze-borne, like a rhythm running through a shadow, then ensnared. Mouth closed, the breaths of agar trees remember the strip of bark and splay of leaf, motions tressed and burdened like a frozen frieze. Dark freckled knuckles winking under silk, spice-scented, deluged, warm wind-draped, lie hollow like coconuts shorn of flesh and milk. If I touched its warble, I'd feel musk, taste something coloured like sultana skin and hear the breaking ball of burnished husks. It's gargling a throat of hot perfume, spat at my helix. It's dripping clothes, my earlobes, wandering wild like a wave of wine in a sober room.
So, Annabel, please join us on stage. Annabel, we all love that poem so much. It came right to the top when we were judging straight away. I particularly loved it because the title, the kind of punning ode to Oud, title made me expect a different kind of poem to the poem that I got. Did the title arrive later, or was the title one of the first things you came up with?
No, the title actually arrived at the end. I'd sort of worked on it, and once I'd got my rhyme scheme sorted, it almost seemed so ironic, because it is an ode in form, but not in traditional rhyme or metre.
And the rhyme does sneak up on you, because it's in three-line stanzas, and the rhyme... It's only the second time I read it, I noticed the rhyme. And that's one of the great things about rhyme, isn't it? That rhyme can sneak up on you, can't it?
Mm. Well, for me, I really thought it echoed the music itself, because it sort of starts off and then you almost lose it. The melody sort of wanders, and then suddenly it comes back to a familiar motif. So I think having the rhyme and then the second line sort of getting lost and then coming back to it for the third one sort of echoed that.
And the poem feels so tightly constructed. I wonder what your process was of drafting and redrafting it.
It really just was making notes from the beginning. And then a rhyme scheme sort of appeared when I realised I was using rhyming words. And then I sort of had to move things between the stanzas until it became in its final form.
And when you start with a rhyme scheme... Sometimes that can be a bit of a straitjacket. It can also be a liberating thing. But when you've set yourself off on one, how difficult is it then to carry on? Because I often find when I'm writing a rhyming poem, the first verse is great. And it does take a while to get the second verse to be as good as the first one.
Absolutely. It can be quite difficult. But I think because I'd written all my content first, it was really just searching for rhymes that would fit with the theme of what I'd written already. So in that way, it was much less difficult than starting off with a rhyme scheme and saying, I'm going to fit what I want to write to this.
And some of the lines, like silk spice scented, hyphenated, three hyphenated words, warm wind draped, the hyphenated words really worked for me because they became new words. That's what it is. If you type three hyphenated words out, the word count tells you you've only got one, and somehow you've got these three words in one. What's the attraction for you of that kind of hyphenation?
Well, it's just really interesting because you're sort of making a passive out of words that sometimes alliterate or sometimes aren't that linked. But I think it's quite a nice way of showing a history, which is something I wanted to bring out because the oud is such an ancient instrument. So really, for me, it was showing the history of the instrument while keeping the poem active and fresh.
And Helen, what was it that attracted you to this poem?
Well, so many things, really. It was an interesting choice of the music, and as I think we've already said, felt as if there was a real synergy again between the spirit of the music and the form of the poem and also the content. It's so sonorous, it's also so visual. There's so many images to savour, like the pair at the very outset, that's really lovely. I think it's a great example as well of how form doesn't have to be a constraint, and how actually even when you're whittling down the poem, and when, so it's very interesting hearing you talk about your process there, and when you're working very hard to shape it and craft it, it actually yields its own freedom as well, because it felt like a very joyous and celebratory poem, and as we've mentioned with some of the others, it still felt as if you were having fun with language and that you were reveling in it. So to have all those things at once, I think, is a real achievement.
So it feels to me that this year we didn't get as many rhyming poems, Judith, as we've had in the past. And this is an example of a really good rhyming poem.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't something I particularly noticed as we went along. And it wasn't the rhyme that got me straight off with this either. I mean, the rhymes are there and they're perfect. But actually, that's one of the things. It wasn't throwing the rhymes in your face. You know, they were there and they worked. I loved that opening, sliced like a pear, pips pop. Mm. So musical. And that line at the end, wandering wild like a wave of wine in a sober room, I'm sure at your age you shouldn't know anything about that. however, you've well observed it. Yes.
And the line like that, in less assured hands, wouldn't have worked as well, because there would have been the temptation to throw in a bit more alliteration, a bit more sonorous language. That's what I liked about this poem so much, that it felt... That word again, confident. It felt confident in its own abilities.
It is. It's abundant, but very controlled as well. I mean, the on the page, it looks beautiful, those three stanzas, three-line stanzas, but also they sort of, they stretch out like strings, as well, because it's a multi-stringed instrument as well, so you've got this sort of different lines going across. It just really conveys that. I have to say, it also brought back to me, there's an episode of The Apprentice where they were sent off to buy an oud and failed desperately, that I'm afraid did also slip back into my mind. And yet it did that, and I still like the poem enormously.
In an early draft, the phrase, "you are fired," appeared, but then disappeared. That's not true. Carolyn, can I ask you about the reading of that poem in particular and the poems in general? Because it feels like a great poem for an actor to read, that one.
Yes, I was very aware I really needed to do a whole series of exercises to warm up my mouth because it really did stretch me. And before going on stage, you'd always do quite a lot of exercises. It really pushed in all directions, and I thought, I'm going to have to do this one again several times. But luckily I got through it. It's beautiful, and it does feel like music as you're doing it. It takes you in many different places, but it's very demanding to recite, actually.
And it's funny, as an actor, you, with a poem like that, it's not a long poem, it's not like you've learnt a part, no. You're not doing a part in a play. No. As a reader, you're like the rest of us when we have to encounter the poem. You have to inhabit the poem within a very small space of time.
Yes, I was told I could talk to any of the poets in advance, and I really didn't want to. I thought they'd put me in another direction. I'd got a very firm image in my head of each of the poems that I read, and I wanted to keep that. It's like, never ask a director how to interpret a part. But also, I appreciate that there are many different ways. Each person here would possibly read out the poems in a different way.
That's the exciting thing about the poem, isn't it? That it can be so many things to different people.
Yes.
So, Annabelle, the poem did feel very, very assured. I wonder how... I'd like to know how long you've been writing. What kind of... Have you always written poems?
Yeah, I'd say I've been working on poetry writing for about the last 5 years. I tried a bit of fiction before, but then I really settled into poetry. And I've been involved with the Ilkley Literature Festival for a few years. I'm a member of their young writers group. And that's really improved my confidence in writing poetry and performing it.
And it is the idea that people get nervous of performing poems, but in fact, the way to get over those nerves is actually to stand up and do it. And then in the end, I always think it's never as bad as you think it's going to be, and the audience often like it, don't they?
Absolutely, and I think you learn a lot about writing poetry when you're reading it as well, because you have a greater awareness of alliteration, assonance, so I think it really improves your later page writing as well, having performed.
That's very true. Annabelle, thank you very much. Now, of course, on Saturday night, we've got the last night of the proms, but earlier in this very room, we're recording a special last night of the proms edition of The Verb with a stage full of guests, including the explorer, Michael Palin. So join us for Land of Verb and Glory. Come and see us then. So now, does anyone in the audience have any questions for our writers? Our roving mic is prepared. I do find with these that telepathy is no good. You have to actually ask us using the medium of language, preferably spoken language and not sign language.
Thank you. I'm still aghast at that first one of a 13-year-old. How did she acquire that knowledge of cosmology or whatever it is and that confidence to put it together? I thought it was just astonishing.
It is an amazing poem by a 13-year-old. When I think of my own 13-year-old poems, they were nothing to do with cosmology. So...
So the Poetry Society runs a lot of projects with young writers, and these poems are all anonymous when we're reading them, but when we are reading the poems by teenage writers, the invention is astounding, and the joy, and the, you know, these are not poets in waiting, you know, they're really, that we have some of our most exciting writers under the age of 18, I think.
And the good thing is, Judith, as you say, that in fact the writer of that age doesn't have to be on their own. As you say, with the Poetry Society, they can become part of a poetic community quite early on in their writing career and feel supported and feel a kind of love around what they're doing, can't they?
There are some amazing projects happening up and down the country. I mean, there's the Writing Squad in the north, Young Poets Network, run by the Poetry Society, for sort of 11 to 25-year-olds. There are lots and lots of young people writing, and the great thing is that the internet does actually now allow young people to find each other and realise they're not the only person writing.
Because, Helen, you were a winner of the Foyle Young Poets Award, and Did you feel a kind of, I don't know, you felt the hands, the arms of the poetry world around you at an early age, I guess, supporting you?
Yeah, that's a nice image. That's it. The arms of the poetry. Yeah, if like a hug. It was
yes,
nice.
A hug.
Yeah, I think, and I should say as well, I've got huge admiration for the 13-year-old who wrote that poem. When I was 13, I didn't know anything about cosmology. I was writing poems about finding a peach stone in the garden and looking at it and thinking it looked a bit like a brain, and then thinking a bit about how I felt a bit depressed, and nothing has really changed in my writing since then. But the amount of distilled knowledge in that piece is incredible. I was someone who'd always written since I was really, really young. Actually, before I could write, I'd sort of dictate poems to my mum, and my long-suffering mum would write them down. And so being part of that community for the first time through the Foyle Young Poets of the Year Award, and meeting my peers and seeing that there were other young people who were writing as well as learning from established poets who were already published, I think that was probably the biggest thing for me in terms of a push to become a writer later on, and to think that other people might be interested in that and I could share it. It's hugely important, because otherwise it can feel very, very lonely, I think, when you're a teenager writing, or an adult writing, in fact. So you need your peers around you.
That's why I like this competition so much, because you might not win a vast amount of money, but what you get is that people will listen to these poems on the radio. People will be sitting at home and they'll turn the poem on, they'll be driving home from somewhere, and they'll hear that poem by the 13-year-old. They'll hear our winners now, runners-up. And hopefully they'll enjoy it, but also they might be inspired to write poems of their own. Let's have another question from the audience. Gentlemen on the fourth row.
I just want to say that I think it's really amazing to have the nerve to, like Rachel Carson did, leave so much unsaid and so much emotional depths. There are depth charges of implication in that poem. Absolutely astonishing. It shows extraordinary nerve. And, of course, trust that people will pick it up like you judges and so on did, and like we hearing it. So I thought that's a quality. Maybe in future you should encourage more people, the unsaid, the implied, rather than the surface pyrotechnics, which is all great fun too.
It's true, isn't it, Helen, that some poems, they do tell us too much. The ones that don't win are the ones that actually, in the first stanza, tell us what they're about to tell us, then they tell us it, then they tell us they've told us it. And Rachel's didn't it? As the gentleman said, it didn't rely on those pyrotechnics.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in the power of the unsaid in poetry. And like you, I love the idea of short poems winning competitions as well, because a short poem can say just as much as a longer piece. And I think it does something special for the reader, that if you know how to harness the power of the unsaid and use silence. Obviously, poetry is a medium that has a relationship to silence and to blank space. And you've got to remember that that's part of what you're working with too. And it's a bit like when we listen to a piece of music, I think often what appeals to people perhaps is that the music leaves space for your own response and for your own thoughts, and everyone might have a different reaction. And that can be true of a poem too. I always like that sense you can get when you're reading a poem where you think, I feel as if I know what they mean by that, but I'm not totally sure. And there's that nice bit of ambiguity there as well.
That's true. Sometimes they do tell us too much. And if you can just add that area of ambiguity, that really helps, like with these poems. Well, let's have another question.
It seems to me that poets seem to need to know a lot about technique and technical stuff. I mean, I wouldn't write poetry because I don't even know what alliteration is. So, as writers of poetry, do you ever just write a poem? It seems that there's such a lot of effort in writing the poems. And I wonder, you know, it always seemed to me that 200 years ago, Schubert just wrote symphonies or he wrote pieces. And the poets he was writing about, the words just flow, and it seems to me much more of a technical exercise. And I wonder if you as poets, do you just have an idea and write it?
Well, I think you don't always have to write to a specific form, so you haven't always got to write a sonnet, or the poem doesn't always have to be alliterative. I think for me, the more poems I read, the freer I feel, you know. So I'll read a lot of poems in all different kinds of styles. And then sometimes I will just sit down and write a poem, and a poem will flow out. But we don't need to feel tied down to form in that way, do we, Judith?
No, I mean, one thing I did want to mention, though, that there were an awful lot of other poems that we really loved that had to be torn from our shortlists with, you know, bitter tearings. And amongst them, there were poems. A couple of people had written notes saying things like, "This is the first poem I've ever written." Yeah. And there was a poem that somebody had written about watching a Steve Reich concert for the first time, watching it, having heard the music but never having seen it performed. And that poem, I loved that poem. And that didn't feel to me like something that somebody had pored and pored and pored over. But you can't tell. You know, and there might have been a line on it that person had been trying to resolve for 3 weeks. To make it look effortless is the thing, but that doesn't mean that something that looks like it came out in a rush actually wasn't really worked over.
You're right, that sometimes some of the most exciting responses to the poems that we had with people who hadn't written a poem before and just thought, I'm excited by this poem or by this music, or I don't like it, or I'm excited by it and I'm going to write this thing that is a poem. And that's an exciting thing to happen.
No, I mean,
it?
Some of them, I mean, like sometimes, you know, you've got something and there's the most amazing line or something. You just think, oh, wow, that is a great line. And if you were doing the greatest line competition, maybe something else would win. But, you know, you're looking for something that's got a great line and another line and another line and another line and has a beautiful form and can bring all of that together.
Finally, let's hear our second runner-up in the 18-plus category, Olga Dermot-Bond's Beauregard's Lament. The poem was inspired by Dawn Soig, Doyne's I Gawr Mawr, heard at the folk music round Britain and Ireland prom. But let's hear an invigorating burst of the music first. Dawn Soig there, Alau with Peter Campbell's orchestration and Jarlath Henderson. So, Caroline, could you read us Beauregard's Lament?
Mother told me I had to keep my virtues safe. Said it was something to be kept, a shut purse. I pictured it instead as cold liquid in cupped hands, such a small well of water dripping through my fingers. Mother warned me of thirsty boys, late-night girls who idled by streams up to their thighs in nakedness, glistening laughter parting so suddenly like ladybird's wings. Once I tried on a friend's lipstick, amazed by the gleaming pout overflowing from a face that was almost beautiful. I had to scrub it off before I got back home, my mouth the colour of the worn-down chopping board Mother kept propped beside the sink, my chin raw from a boy's rough kisses, my heart like a bitten lip. Mother taught me how to stitch, each Sunday filled with tiny crosses like stale bread, boredom a mat I wiped my feet on so as not to dirty the silence of Father counting pages of his Bible like money. Mother is dead now. Old dust floats lonely, my hips stiff from sweeping an empty house. I realize now I was made to swim through air. I should have come back breathless from nights in ill-kept forests with men who I had let fly with me, my thin-as-a-lick wings still beating hard the next morning like a rush of bad blood.
Beauregard's Lament by Olga Dermot-Bond. Now, Helen, the images in that poem just get coming. My mouth the colour of the worn-down chopping board. What a fantastic line. My heart like a bitten lip. And it felt to me like it reminded me that a good poem can be built from many things, but it can also be built from images, can't it? And that one was.
Yeah, I absolutely love the images in this. With the heart like a bitten lip is, so again, so surprising. And I think that the whole piece, again, has so much passion behind it. It feels it's incredibly inviting to read. And that actually goes back to the question we were asked just now, because it's so important. We are looking for poems that wear their technique lightly, that there's lots of control, but that is all kind of under the surface. But we are also looking for passion and for heart and to feel that somebody's been carried away by a feeling or a thought and an idea. That's always in a good poem too, I think.
And Judith, the poem was inspired by folk-like music, by folk music, and When I read it, it felt like a folktale. It felt like a translation from a folktale that I thought I knew from somewhere.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, most folktales or, you know, the sort of lament is, oh, I wish I never had gone and met the man at the edge of the woods. Mm. And this is the lament for having stayed behind and led a decent life. So I think it's both a sort of a folk poem and the reverse of a folk poem. She hasn't got pregnant and had to bury her baby at the crossroads or all the things that normally happen in such tales.
Because a bubachod is a household spirit, and I definitely got the sense, though, of spirits and ghosts dancing around the edges of this poem, just off out of our eyesight.
Well, it's been, you know, she's lived this this life, but in her imagination, she's been imagining all the things she shouldn't have done are there actually as alive as maybe the things that she might have done.
And again, this poem, Helen, was in couplets, this year's favourite form. There's something about the couplet, isn't there, that rings true for this poem, definitely, but also seems to be something for our, I don't know, for our turbulent times, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe it's something about the security of the couplet, or maybe it's also something that happens naturally when you're asked to pair two things together, when you're asked to pair music with words, maybe couplets come out of that as well.
And summing up what we had this year, do you think that one thing that I noticed was, I mentioned just then that we're living through turbulent times, there wasn't a lot of nostalgia in the poems that we got?
No, I mean, I think last year there were a lot of poems that had a kind of fracture down the middle where people had written a poem that began on one side of the page and finished, you know, with a gap in the middle. Mm. And there was a lot of this piece of music takes me back to thinking about 1974. There wasn't that at all, actually. They were very present.
Did you find that, Helen, that was an overriding thing for me, that people weren't looking back? They were looking around and they were looking forward.
Yeah, and it felt very much that people were reimagining things, but that's not the same as nostalgia. It was as if they were bringing things into the present, and there were some strange juxtapositions going on, some quite daring ones, I think.
It felt to me, having read all the poems, having heard them read tonight, having talked to the winners, having met the runners-up, that poetry feels like, I don't like the phrase, but it's in a good place. I think a lot of poems are being written, a lot of poems are being read, and I think poetry is doing very well. Partly, of course, because of the Proms Poetry Competition, I'm sure you'll agree. That's all we got time for tonight. Just time to say very well done to our winners and to everybody who entered the competition. And thanks to my fellow judges, Helen Mort and Judith Palmer, and to Carolyn Pickles for reading the poems. Thank you very much.
The Radio 3 Proms Poetry Competition was presented by Ian McMillan and produced by Fiona McLean.
This autumn, Sound of Dance returns to BBC Radio 3. I'm Katie Derham, and I'll be exploring the world of dance through music, from classic ballet scores to the joyful world of tap. And I meet the international ballet star, Carlos Acosta. The new season of Sound of Dance starts with a focus on Mary Rombert. Next Saturday afternoon at 3 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to this Monday evening. Jazz Now is on its way in a little over 5 minutes' time. Until then, a dance pantomime by Eric Satie, his Jack in the Box. It was first staged in 1926, the year after Satie died, by Diaghilev's Ballet Russe. The pianist is Jean-Yves Thibaudet. Eric Satie's ballet pantomime Jack in the Box, written in 1925 and played there by Jean-Yves Thibaudet. Satie called it a clownery and also a suite anglaise, and it looks as if he gave it an English title because English phrases were thought fashionable in Parisian society at the time. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 on FM. We're on DAB Digital Radio and we're live online in HD sound. It's 11 o'clock.
Hi, this is Jazz Now and a very warm welcome tonight from me, Al Ryan. So where's Soweto Kinch, I hear you say? Well, tonight Jazz Now comes from underneath a Birmingham motorway. This apparently unpromising setting happens to be the venue for the flyover show, started exactly 10 years ago by our very own Soweto Kinch.
The flyover show was conceived really to be a transformative event, to transform the physical environments of where the space is, but also to evangelise for the sort of music, the sort of creativity that I believe Birmingham should be even more famous for. You know, the area in particular in Hockley is always just renowned for gang violence or deprivation or unemployment, racial, you know, strife and conflict, whereas actually there's this really cohesive community and another narrative that I think art is the best way of telling.
Well, for those of you who've run a festival, you know they're demanding children, so in between playing, organising and a host more tasks, Soweto will catch up with us again later. Now, over the next 90 minutes or so, we've a bag full of treats in store for you, reflecting the diversity of this unique event in the shape of Ayanna Whitter-Johnson, Zara McFarlane and Blue Lab Beats. So let's get to it. Blue Lab Beats are London duo NKOK and Mr. DM. Their work mixes elements of hip-hop and electronic dance music with classic jazz influences.
I'd like to present to you the incredible Blue Lab Beats!
Hello, people. Welcome to the Blue Lab Beats live experience, where we mix a little bit of jazz with a whole lot of hip-hop. My name is NKOK, and on this side right here, you have Mr. DM. Some of you, of course, may know him as David Marakpour, and we are Blue Lab Beats. We started as a production team, then decided to take this whole music thing a lot more seriously by making our own sound and taking that sound onto the road that leads us here today. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take you all on a musical journey.